we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
In wartime, seeing is not always believing.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary.
Just follow up on just a little bit.
I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Be either with us or you're against us.
Outcome is assured.
News Dissector here, and talking today again, as we do every week, about the media, and joining me on the in the studio live, Lisa Vives, who works with the Global Information Network and who has been writing about Africa in the newsletter every single week, trying to interest us more about the details of what's happening in Africa and what it means to all of us. And of course, what we find in Africa today are urgent issues like Ebola, like Boko Haram in Nigeria, but beyond that, issues of development, issues of economic prosperity and a lack of prosperity, poverty, and people who are struggling to make a better life for themselves. So Lisa Vives, a reporter here years ago with the Jersey Journal, who's been a journalist and an editor for many years and now works with IPS, the Interpress Service, is doing a remarkable job of actually covering these issues and trying to find ways to interest Americans in these issues. And they're getting a lot of pickup in what's left of the black press in America, community newspapers and the like. Hi, Lisa. What brought you into this interest with Africa?
Well, I sort of slid into it. I was working on a newsletter on Guatemala for some years. But I never thought of it as doing journalism. I just thought I'm going to let people know what's going on, the human rights abuses that were happening at that time. And then one day I found myself looking for a job, and one opened up in New Jersey at the Jersey Journal, as you mentioned. And I jumped. I said, okay, why not? I didn't get the job right away because they didn't have many women there at the time, but I was persistent. And about 3 months later, they said, okay, we'll give you a chance. And that was the beginning of a love affair to this day.
A love affair with journalism.
With journalism. So you want to...
So, Lisa, we're having a little confusion here because the guest that I was going to have on before you wasn't there when we called him. Most people, I find, do not run their lives like a radio host, where you have to be on time and on the moment. You agree to be available at a certain time, you're there. And other times, you're not there. And in this case, we have the situation. So thank you for being with us. We want to talk with you about Africa. Now, what brought you into this interest in Africa, and how did it develop?
I guess I was working as an editor at IPS, so we were doing world news, and it was around the time that Nelson Mandela came out of jail, and a lot of the publications that we worked with said, well, what else do you have? Do you have more? We want more. And so I began to fill in for IPS and write some stories so that papers could have more information. So some of the stories, you know, I found online from publications that I felt were reliable, and then I began to write myself. So then I found that people really wanted a broad view of Africa. There's 54 countries. We barely get news from three or four. So I started looking for to bring in what's going on in Namibia, what's going on in Botswana, you know, and make those countries come to life. So that was a challenge, and I enjoyed it.
There's always been a tendency in the American media, if you will, to ensure that Africa is the dark continent in the sense that there's very little reporting going on there, except in the cases of, coups, emergencies, epidemics of various kinds, or wars. And that seems to get attention, but not really sustained attention, because the origins and the causes of all of this, the historical background of a lot of these African stories, don't really get presented very clearly. So it reinforces this idea that somehow Africa, you know, is underdeveloped people and savage and the like. And that stereotype is still with us in many cases, even as, you know, African leaders are you know, play a big role in on the world scene.
Right. So I found that, you know, I could fill in the stories that mainstream media or commercial media was overlooking, like that there are unions, labor unions, and people fighting for better wages. There are schools and parents trying to get better education. There are so many things that we can identify with here, but that don't get any coverage. So that's what I was looking for.
Now, you do a weekly newsletter. Like, what's in this week's? Tell us what you covered and why you covered those issues.
Well, Jacob Zuma is the president of South Africa. And what happens when there's not good coverage, you know, people tend to think, oh, South Africa, he's the leader, he must be good. So, in fact, a lot of South Africans are really disappointed in him. And what happened was he built a little chateau for himself and used taxpayer money, and people were very upset. So there was a public prosecutor, and she looked into it. What happened was then the ANC started throwing eggs at her and vilifying her, and she should go back to Russia. She was a counter-revolutionary working for the CIA. So it's an amazing story, and people came to her defense, including this major church group, it's social justice group, and they came to her defense. So it's a fascinating story, and she's really sticking to her guns, and the ANC is going to have to answer to the things that she discovered in her investigation, and Jacob Zuma may have to pay back for these things that he built in his little chateau, like a swimming pool and an amphitheater and the chicken
run. Corruption is not new, and it's certainly not African at all. You know, many countries have corrupt leaders and corrupt presidents. But I think in a country where people had high hopes for change, where Nelson Mandela, you know, represented change and try to offer, a different approach to politics, I think there's a particular sense of being let down or disillusioned with the Zuma, even though Zuma comes from the ANC, was actually part of its armed struggle, was a courageous person, was in prison. At the same time, he seems to be part of a whole elite there that is sort of, shall we say, sold in, not just sold out.
Yeah, very, very true. So the story is not about the corruption. It's really about somebody who was strong enough and had enough cojones, as they say, to stand up and keep standing up. And that's what this woman did. I think she's a tremendous example. And that's the kind of story we should hear, and we should know more about her, and we should invite her here to and people in South Africa appreciate what she did. I listened to this talk radio show, 702 COZA, and people were calling in, and they said, saying, good for her, speak up, you know. everybody wanted to talk about it. So it was a big story there and getting really little coverage here. So I wrote about it from that angle.
In doing so, you also make a big effort to try to focus on the people involved, not just the issues, but also, you know, who these people are and what they're up against and trying to make change. I think that's an approach that encourages people to get more engaged with the work and with the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm somebody who has a long background in covering South Africa and working on South African issues. But, you know, I think important that we recognize that, you know, because Mandela was released from prison, you know, so many years ago, or became president and served his term, that doesn't end the story. The story is continuing, and it's still part of a fight for global justice.
Mm. Actually, the other story I did this week was about Eskom in South Africa, and it's about Greenpeace, which has an African branch. And they've been organizing people to say no more coal dust. This coal dust is getting in our lungs. There's children dying young because of the coal dust. And it's a story about resistance. And I think that's a story that we also need to hear here. We don't hear enough about resistance. And I thought it was an important story.
We certainly don't hear enough of it in the mainstream media, which tends to follow the news agenda. I mean, today in South Africa, the big story is, you know, about the person, Pistorius, the runner, who is charged now with negligence, not murder. And that's been a case that's gotten a lot of attention in the world media because he was a famous global athlete, and he's a disabled athlete, and the rest of it. At the same time, the justice system there really acquitted itself, I think, rather fairly. I mean, there was a lot of people who felt like this guy should be convicted and punished on the spot, you know. And there was judicial process, and he did have rights as an accused person to present his case. We still don't know the final outcome, what the final sentence will be, but it seemed as if the judge, a woman, did a very good job of sorting out what the facts are and trying to make sure that this person, even though he was a high-profile person charged with a heinous crime of killing his own girlfriend, you know, deserved also to have his day in court.
All right. You're really right about that. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge that most people in South Africa, most blacks, don't get that kind of good justice. And a lot of them are rotting in jails, and they're not getting their day in court. You know, if they had good lawyers like Pistorius had, maybe they'd also be walking home today.
So the inequities in the judicial system are as deeply embedded there as anywhere else, with one exception, perhaps, is that South Africa has one of the most advanced constitutions in the world, guaranteeing rights for the people there on a much deeper level than in many countries, including our own.
Yeah. Some people say there's a lot of that constitution that's just paper. But still, you know, I think the population believes in it, and it's still a document that they hold, and they say these are our rights. Whereas I think we've completely forgotten what our rights are here.
In writing about this, you know, you're also, in a sense, talking about, a continent which has a lot of descendants, let's say, in the United States. They're African Americans who came to this country as slaves initially, but who have, you know, fought for justice in this country. There is a link of heritage and history, even though in some instances it hasn't really been taught in the schools very much. We just read earlier this week, and I had in my blog, the story of a big slave rebellion in South Carolina that was not given any coverage in the mainstream media. It was the sort of story that was totally missing in movies like 12 Years a Slave. So our own history is often very selective and doesn't really do justice, if you will, to the African American community and what it struggled, what it suffered, and the like. And so there is a connection here, and maybe because the African American community isn't as wealthy in generally as other communities, it doesn't get the same media coverage.
Well, certainly it doesn't get any positive media coverage, or very little. But I think that's where there's some commonality that the people on both sides of the ocean are looking at each other and saying, you know, all I hear is bad things. You know, should I really link up with this group that's, you know, maybe there's nothing good you can say about them? And so there's been a distancing. And every so often there's, you know, a rapprochement, but generally it's been, you know, we don't know what's going on over there, but it doesn't look good. And that's something you hear from both sides. So this is a process, and I'm so thrilled that some of the black press has picked up stories from Africa, because I think we can work towards this rapprochement.
I think that people are hungry for information. They want to know more. They realize that their issues don't get the coverage, except, of course, in Nigeria, the Boko Haram, you know, is kind of Islamic terror group, has been getting, you know, a lot of attention. But, you know, it's not, you know, the sufferings of the Nigerian people that prompted the U.S. to get involved in a high-profile military way, but the ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
And I think that PBS Frontline did the most amazing report this week by showing not only Boko Haram is committing vile abuses, but the Nigerian military. I mean, there were images there that, you know, just you had to run to the bathroom. It was so sickening. So this is the Nigerian military, and this is an unreported story. It's really unfortunate. And even the Nigerian media hadn't fully covered the sins of the military that really just turns guns over to militants or militias, and then they wash their hands of them, and then they go and kill everybody, you know, without courts, without, you know, hearings, without justice.
There's a movie playing in New York, which you should see if you haven't, or anywhere else in the country, in the world, about Fela, the Nigerian musician who was also an advocate for human rights. I was privileged to have known him. And this movie, talks about his music and his appeal and his popularity as somebody who stood up against the Nigerian military, who stood up for social justice. And he later died of AIDS. But at the same time, he is still a cultural hero to people in Africa and to people in Nigeria. So this movie about Fela is something, F-E-L-A, that you would want to see and get a sense of somebody who's a character in every respect, you know, who was an artist, was an iconoclastic personality, but he was very willing to battle for not only his rights, but the rights of the people in his community. And those are the sorts of people who don't get the kind of attention that they often deserve. And there are many of them in Africa.
And that's the point there. You know, this week we're going to have Salif Keita, or next week, the 18th at SOBs. And Salif Keita stood up for albinos. Now, in Africa, there's a lot of superstition about albinos, and in some parts of Africa, they're harvested for body parts. And, you know, not only did he defy his family, but he formed some foundations and things. So that's one, but there are many. There's one in Cameroon, there's one here, there's one there.
I saw a tremendous movie about that at the film festival in Zanzibar in East Africa about the plight of albino people in Tanzania and about the fight they had for recognition and justice.
The beauty queen Lupita Nyong'o actually made a film. It's called Not in My Genes or In My Genes, which is actually about albino. She focuses on that in Kenya and that
she's
area.
The star of 12 Years a Slave, one of the stars of that movie. Now, talk to me now about this Ebola situation. There is some people feel like if this had been tracked earlier, if there had been more resources thrown at it, they could have stopped it. But now it seems out of control. What is the reality of Ebola right now? And is the media doing a good job in covering it?
Well, actually, I think it's you can't read about it and feel it. When I saw this movie on Frontline this week, it was the first time it really came to life to see families, you know, husbands and wives children being left alone, things like that. You know, when I first started to read about it, my first thought was, you know, all this development money that goes to different countries, and money is there for hospitals, but for some reason they don't get built, and there's not enough. So if there's a crisis, there aren't any. I mean, the number of hospitals or doctors in Liberia was like 5 to 5 million. You know, there was no way Liberia could meet this challenge. So, you know, so now they're trying to rectify it a little bit, but, you know, how they're going to slow it down, slow the infection rate down, something that we'll be talking about on Wednesday at our roundtable.
And to tell us the date again, and people might want to come to this. I think it's a very interesting event.
So it's a roundtable on Ebola, and we have a journalist from Togo who just came back from the region. We have an American epidemiologist who also worked in West Africa. We have Milton Alamadi from the Black Star News. So it's Wednesday, the 17th, 6:30, and the address is 220 Fifth Avenue. It's at 6:30 p.m. We're on the fifth floor, and all are welcome.
I've been to some of these discussions, and I think they really bring an interesting crowd out to talk about some of these issues. What is your take on Ebola? You know, the World Health Organization seems to have been caught, you know, off guard. They don't have the resources. They're not playing a leadership role here. It's typical, if you will, of some U.N. agencies, and that they're very bureaucratic, based in Geneva. You know, they say the right things and issue reports, but don't seem to be able to mobilize the kind of engagement that this needs. And it's scary when you see healthcare workers and doctors succumbing to this disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here we really don't know, you know, what can be done. What can we do, if we can do anything? When they said this is not like HIV/AIDS, it's not contagious in that way. But in fact, this epidemiologist will talk about it. When you have blood spilt, the blood will dry, and that dried blood becomes airborne. So it is something that could be in the air as well, and could explain why the contagion is so great. But this film on Frontline, which I hope will show some of it, shows, you know, the WHO, who was Liberian, and another Liberian who, you know, are so courageous, and they go into the rural areas, and people are so afraid, you know, and they that fear is what's creating a contagion, which I don't know how they'll stop it.
You know, it is a bit weird that the U.S. has committed to build a hospital in Liberia, but not for Liberians. Oh, in the same way, you know, that they've managed to get some of this serum, which has been effective for people suffering from Ebola, and given it to Americans, not to Africans. And there's a lot of bad vibe and bad feeling about all this. Is this sort of all too typical?
Well, the doctors there were saying that what they try to do is rebuild the person's immune system. So by hydrating them and by giving them medicine so that they don't throw up their food, they can rebuild. And that's what we saw, a woman who had the symptoms, and she just went for this treatment, and then she was cured. So,
call again.
So these stories of, you know, these people aren't taking ZMAP or anything like that, but there are cures. You know, there are people being cured, and that we need to know more about.
Well, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about all of this, also about where, the spread of these diseases, AIDS, in southern Africa, having its origins to some degree, and experiments done under colonialism and the like. I mean, how seriously do you take all that?
Well, some people say, you know, all the Africa Rising stories, you know, it took a week or a 2 weeks for all of that to be wiped away, and people talking about the bush meat, the exotic practices, you know, just like taking everything that we thought we would never hear any more about, and it's it's
they're blaming the victims for the disease.
Exactly.
Isn't
exactly.
that what's happening?
Yes, exactly.
And
yeah.
in that respect, is that is there any truth to that, or do you think that this is one more example of you know, a Western medical kind of empire that's not oriented to serving the needs of the poor and certainly people in developing countries?
I just look at the fortunes that are given to African leaders as part of development money, but it's really not development money. It's shut up money, so that these mines and these you know, investments in Africa can continue, and they're not transparent. People don't know what the countries are getting at. And that's what's leaving the countries broke, unable to build what they need to build to protect their citizens.
What about, and what can our listeners do to find out more about these issues? How can they get access to what you publish?
Well, you know, there is a paper in the city called the Amsterdam News, and we're on page 2, the international news section. There's Black Star News, which is online, and we're published there. There's the Beacon paper. We're published there. We're in some papers outside of the city. I don't know if you can find the Michigan Citizen. There's some papers that are just online. So, and we have a Facebook. We're looking for volunteers to help us build up our social media portion, because we don't really have that going on right now.
And what about Interpress Service, IPS? It's been around for a long time. Does it continue to have a role to play?
Well, hopefully there's going to be there's some new faces there. There's a new director who's a journalist from India. He's been writing and journaling for, you know, 30 or 40 years. And I think he has a good idea of what this service should be. It should be for the voiceless, the voice for the voiceless. Unfortunately, you know, the economy for independent media is not good these days, as you probably know. And so there's some struggling going on. But I think if they tighten up their ship, there can be, you know, a new opportunity for them.
Lisa Vives of Global Information Network, who's very kindly joined us today. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, and stay with us for more.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I work at ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Byron, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Well, we're trying to not manage the message, but try to understand the message and critique it and get to know a little bit more about it. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio. And I'm here with Lisa Vives of the Interpress Service, who's been a journalist for a long time in the independent sphere, in the arena of alternative media, and, you know, has been focusing on Africa. But, you know, we're now facing a global situation, and I'm trying to examine with you what are Americans learning about it. And I wanted to get your take on this. Last night, or this past week, President Obama went on television calling for a sustained drive to rout militants. He announced he's going to send 475 more advisors to Iraq, mount attacks on ISIS in Syria. And now Israel says, you know, they're likely to join in, as will Saudi Arabia, as possibly will Iran. Everybody finds ISIS particularly scary and particularly evil, perhaps because of the beheadings that were very publicized of American journalists. There were other beheadings of Saudi dissidents that did not get the same publicity. You know, so we're in another environment where war as a story drives everything else off the agenda. And here's the New York Times in front of me, and across the top of it are three stories. The Obama's there looking earnest, speaking to the public. There's a news analysis about extending a legacy of war. And then also there's a story called Struggling to Gauge the Threat, even as U.S. prepares to act. And, you know, to their credit, the New York Times actually has some critical ideas, although you have to jump down one, two, three, four paragraphs in this article to get at any critical information. And they're actually quoting somebody named Daniel Benjamin, who served as the State Department's top counterterrorism advisor during Obama's first term. And he said that the U.S. Discussion about the ISIS threat, and this is very strong words for a former State Department counterterrorism chief, he said it's a farce, with members of the cabinet and top military officers all over the place describing the threat in lurid terms that are not justified. He goes on to say, it's hard to imagine a better indication of the ability of elected officials and TV talking heads to spin the public into a panic. Now, it's unusual to find this sort of criticism. We didn't see it the day before the speech. We didn't seem to see critical voices being heard as the policy was gelling. But there are people, at least, who are questioning all of this. But they're doing so, you know, in a way after the policy has been determined. What's your take on that?
I really don't see much difference between how we hyped up going into Iraq or how we hype it up going into any country. Look what we did in Libya. I mean, we removed Gaddafi, and then we a can of worms opened up. And now we have the most frightening situation, a chaos without leaders, without any direction. You know, Libyans live in terrible fear of what's happening to their country. Syria, of course, is another example. So, you know, I right now we're painting ISIS and these, you know, fangs and horns and things like that. But how different is it? And how effective can we be when our strategy hasn't worked yet? And
let's talk about what that strategy is. The strategy is basically bombing. Okay, we don't want to send ground troops there. So we want to just bomb them from the air. We've tried this before. Bombing didn't work in the end in Vietnam. You know, there was more bombs dropped on Vietnam than in all of World War II. And guess what the outcome was? We lost, okay? Ditto for the Iraq War. There was a tremendous amount of bombing. Afghanistan, a tremendous amount of bombing and now droning, killing people, and it's not working. What gives them and anyone the confidence to think that it's going to be any different?
You know, I think this is all politicians trying to please politicians, and it has nothing to do with either what's going to really happen on the ground, which will probably be security forces that are private mercenaries will go there, and then eventually more troops will go there, and then it'll look like Iraq all over again. But, you know, I think this is all focused on, you know, how can we quiet Rand Paul, or how can we quiet McCain, or how can we, you know, this is Democrats and Republicans trying to, you know, trying to satisfy each other that we're the toughest guy on the block and we're taking action and things like that. But it's no reflection of what's really going to happen on the ground.
Well, the people seem to know ISIS well and, you know, point out how it evolved. It's been around for quite a while. It's not a new phenomenon. You know, are very shall we say, unenthusiastic about this latest effort, because there's no discussion of politics. There's no discussion of mobilizing people. There seems to be the ideas a bad spot, you know, kind of thing. And that ISIS is suddenly the evil doers that, you know, Bush loved. You know, remember his speech about the evil, you know, how we were fighting evil.
I don't think ISIS is an old thing that's been around. I mean, there's been insurgents forever, but we have a group now that has our top military equipment, you know, our materiel. They have all that stuff that we either gave them or they bought or they captured. So they're very powerful. This is a new group that not only that, they were making $1 billion a day selling oil. So they're not poor. They're not without weapons. This is a new monster.
And it's a monster which critics believe we help create and encourage. And, you know, because this whole idea of we're going to support moderate rebels in Syria, we've been hearing this for years, okay? Mm-hmm. And the Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other countries have been training so-called moderates who end up not being so moderate, you know, in the end of the day. And we have the same pattern that's been going on, not successful from the viewpoint of restoring freedom, which is what we claim to be supporting. And so here we are in a situation where another country will be torn apart in the chase for the evil ones, and in this case, ISIS. But it seems like the outcome of it is already clear that this will go on for years, and that there will be no firm resolution of the problem, because if they wipe out ISIS, somebody else will come along. This is what happened with Al-Qaeda. They wiped out Al-Qaeda. They killed bin Laden, or they supposedly wiped them out. And then guess what? Now we have a new threat, which is even worse than the one we supposedly replaced.
So, I don't want to say let's not look at ISIS and let's not talk about ISIS, but we need to talk about the things that are changing on the ground here that are for the better. And this demonstration that's coming up on the 21st for the environment, let's say there are 1 million people there. That's going to turn the tables a little bit, you know, and I think people will realize that there's a lot of stupidity in the people who say there's no, the world isn't heating up and there's no, you know,
so this is the climate march in New York. I was at the big march on the nuclear issue that brought 1 million people into the streets years ago. Now, we didn't really achieve very much from it, but at least we put the issue on the agenda. And I think this climate change march will do the same. And this is something where, you know, hundreds and hundreds of organizations have committed to participate in. It's getting virtually no attention in the mainstream press, but it is word of it is getting out online and on Twitter, on Facebook, and a lot of other social media outlets.
Well, there are some unions who are backing it, and there's this organization called Green Faith, which is a lot of church groups, and they're into it, and they're getting their flocks and to come. You know, this is going to be some new populations out there, and I'm very excited about it.
So in a sense, the last people to find out about it or to know about it is the media again, who are, you know, still fighting the last war. And in fact, in its editorial today, I don't know if you saw this, the attack on ISIS expands to Syria. This is like a straight out support for this war. On page one, you have at least a critical voice questioning it. But on the editorial page, it's like gung ho. Let's go, guys. This has been necessary, because of the threat and danger of all of this, even though the people in Homeland Security and other people say there is no particular danger. Nevertheless, we need a danger. And this is the point I was getting at. We seem to really need a threat to galvanize people. When Obama wanted to bomb Assad in Syria over chemical weapons, and even to this day, we don't really have conclusive evidence of what actually happened, cooler heads prevailed and Putin stepped in and they negotiated some resolution. So he didn't do the bombing. Now he claims that he has the authority to do it, which is questionable legally, and that he's going to do it. But what is it going to achieve and what is it going to accomplish? And the people who have looked at it closely really question, all of this. It's just a sort of a knee-jerk reaction you know, we have an Air Force, so let's use it, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of this is, you know, unfortunately, I feel like we just, you know, we're repeating itself. And I think your point about how this is a reflection and an outgrowth of a paralyzed American domestic political scene where people have been screaming at each other and hurling insults at each other for the last 6 or 7 years, a Congress completely incapable of acting that has, you know, kind of a popularity of maybe 10%, you know, among the American people, if that. And, you know, and so somehow the Obama administration feels, well, he's being criticized, so he has to act. You know, Fox News is going to call him a weakling, you know. Mm-hmm. And all of this is kind of a crazy way to make policy, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And that's why I think we have to nourish, you know, these popular social justice, civil society movements, which I think are the only hope to counter this craziness at the top. Without popular movements and people, you know, who are angry enough to stand in the street and lay down or get arrested or start an Occupy, you know, there's nobody out there to challenge these crazies who are running our country.
I read an interesting account from the Pew Research Center today, you know, which has been reporting a growing percentage of people who are upset with the CIA horror show and the massive surveillance state that's been, you know, run by the NSA and who want this brought under control. And their most recent poll says, oh, no, the public is mostly concerned with security. They're afraid the government isn't doing enough to protect us. And therefore, they don't want to dismantle all of this stuff, even though the spying is not being done on ISIS. It's being done on them, which they don't seem to realize. OK, but nevertheless, you know, and the article basically said, well, the reason for it is they're scared. And so it shows you again how people can be scared into believing the worst and acting against their better judgment and their better instincts.
I think, though, you know, what we really don't know yet is how do you reach the minds, the hearts and the minds of American people today? Because there's not, I don't think people, especially young people, are tuning in to the 7 o'clock news or the 9 o'clock news. So, you know, and if I look at the New York Times and I see that it's either Ukraine today or ISIS tomorrow, you know, and that's about what's happening in the world. But I don't think people in America understand these things or are even hearing most of it. It's just like a buzz that goes on around and, you know, people are listening to music. I have students that don't have radios, that don't have TVs. They just program their, you know, their devices to have the music they like. So how are we going to reach ordinary people and inform them
today? Well, in a
today?
Sense, this is a little scary because, you know, we always thought, or we at least I grew up thinking, okay, an informed citizenry is important. People are informed. They will organize in their best interest. They will try to promote change. They'll be upset with injustice. They'll be upset with, you know, kind of abuse by the government, and we'll fight back against it. That's been the operating assumption. Now what we find is that a lot of people aren't paying attention at all. You know, the big story of the week, you may think it was President Obama, 9/11, you know, his big speech. No, the big story of the week was 9/9, the introduction by Apple of its new phones and its new stopwatch. That seems to be what, you know, got the most attention and the most buzz, if you will, online media and the rest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about possessions. It's about consumption. We've just had a figure thrown out, which is amazing. You know, we're now up to over $3 trillion in consumer debt. Now, this is one of the biggest threats and dangers facing the American people. Mm-hmm. There's going to come a point when you cannot pay this debt. Mm-hmm. And we already know how many people have lost their homes, lost cars, lost, you know, kind of had repossessions mm-hmm. because they've overindulged and are living, if you will, at a worse level than ever. families, you know, people aren't working, can't find jobs, there are no jobs, and all the rest of it. And that's not seen as a threat. That's not seen as a danger. You know, that's just seen as a fact of life. Mm-hmm. And that's very disturbing, if you will, that there's no attention being paid to, and it's not like I'm preaching, but, you know, to the economic realities that many Americans are experiencing. Mm-hmm. And they think a new iPhone is what they need to reconnect them with the public, to have the latest technology. And at the same time, you know, being able to afford all this. You know how much people spend on online media? It's obscene, if you will.
I'm not going to knock, you know, these devices, because from what I learned about Africa, you know, these devices were used to bring people out in the street and organize, you know, for bread and organize against certain things. So they have their purpose, and they can do things. I just think, you know, look at the election of Cuomo. You know, if people were aware, how could they vote for this guy? You know, the union, the labor paper said the smirky. I mean, they really knocked him. They call him the short guy, the smirky guy. He got elected. He dismantled an anti-corruption team that was looking into what he was doing. And he said, okay, well, that's enough, folks. You know, go home.
Yeah, particularly when you had two incredible candidates in this recent election, Tim Wu and Teach Out. You know, who seem to be really representing a new kind of politics in the state of New York. And, you know, they were just because they didn't have the money to buy, you know, visibility, to have ads and all the rest of it. You can have a great message, but if people don't hear that message, it doesn't have the impact that you'd like it to have. And this isn't really the New York Times did not endorse anyone for governor. Why? Because the critic, you know, Teach Out, what's her first name? I'm sorry.
Zephyr.
Zephyr. I never get that right. Okay, Zephyr, who's this brilliant young woman, incredible dynamo, who's running for a first time. She doesn't have a track record. So the New York Times cannot make any kind of judgment on her, and so they don't. They did support Wu for a lieutenant governor. He is a Columbia professor, a law professor and the like. He's one of the people who came up with the whole idea of net neutrality. So he had a track record that they could use to justify an endorsement. But Andrew Cuomo, you know, you couldn't ask people here one thing that he has done and anybody tell you what he's done. But it doesn't seem to matter because it's all about his brand, his branding the Cuomo family, the kind of Cuomo dynasty and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And this is what gets reinforced in the media. Ideas don't seem to matter very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm just, what you're suggesting, though, is a whole different approach. You're suggesting, from what I gather, is to, you know, two components, which is seek out non-establishment media, seek out online media, seek out media about the rest of the world, and don't just rely on, you know, kind of Facebook or, you know, American celebrity news, if you will. Mm-hmm. And secondly, get involved at the community level in movements that can try to bring about change. And we have this massive march taking place in New York on the 20th?
21st. You know where it starts?
Tell me.
So it's 11:30. It's going to meet at Columbus Circle. And they're going to walk down 6th Avenue, I believe, and then cut over to 38th Street
and then
rally.
And then to the United Nations.
No. They don't have, as far as I know, they don't have a permit for that. They'll be on the all the
amazing,
way.
Isn't it? Here's the UN, supposedly the big leaders of the climate change movement, not connected and not involved in all this. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have here is an opportunity to take part in history. And I think that the people who took part in historical movements for change and moments of change really were changed by them. I know I was as a youngster involved in the civil rights movement and the March on Washington. When I say it, I sound like an old fogey, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was at the time, 18 years old, and it changed my life in many ways for the better, mm-hmm. and got me into journalism and got mm-hmm. me interested in social issues. And mm-hmm. that's what our challenge is how do we get engaged and not simply look at the world as a spectator, mm-hmm. as somebody who is, kind of watching what other people do and, mm-hmm. Talking about Joan Rivers as opposed to talking about rivers, mm-hmm. what's happening to our planet. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is important. And that's why also, Lisa, I really admire your work, because you're not in it for the money, obviously. you're not in it for the fame. You're mm-hmm. doing something that's a real service. And I'm sure there must be some frustrating moments also when you don't mm-hmm. know if you're going to have the resources to keep going.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited by a project that Milton Alamadi has been running, which is called Guerrilla Journalism. And he got a group of people. They meet in Brooklyn, and he's teaching people to have confidence. I didn't go to college for journalism. I sort of learned that by the seat of my pants, and it became a love affair. And I think people, they look up to journalists and they wish they could do it, but they can do it. And I think more people should jump in.
Well, just for a little plug here, mediachannel.org has been going for a long time, 2002. And what we try to do is feature reports and articles and interviews with people in every aspect of media life. And this radio show is one way of doing it, but also, the website has articles from all over the world, tries to provoke an interest in questions about what the media is and is not covering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's our challenge, if you will. I've been working on this media issue because it's obvious to me that we wouldn't be going to war if the media didn't play up these beheadings the way it did. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. And those beheadings directly, if you go back to World War I, mm-hmm. you'll find that these atrocities were featured in all the papers, was used to recruit people mm-hmm. for the war. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, there was one website called Site, S-I-T-E, which is a pro-Israeli site that really covered disseminated these disgusting videos. In a way, they helped make ISIS case for them, but they also made the case for war against ISIS. And so this is a media war, once again, that's taking place, and it's something that we need to pay very close attention to. How is it being covered? What questions are being raised? What's not being raised? And all the rest of it. And we're just two journalists here trying to raise some of these questions in the hopes that you, our listeners, will find this of interest. Mm-hmm. Do you find it of interest?
I certainly do, and I hope to see your audience and you come out on Wednesday for a roundtable on Ebola, and come out on the 21st for the March for Climate Justice.
Lisa Vives, editor, Global Information Network, Africa specialist, but journalist and humanist. Thank you for joining us. I'm Danny Schechter.
Thank you very much.
Your News Dissector.
Okay.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
Again, thank you for being there. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You'll be able to hear this program on PRN.FM and also on MediaChannel.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. We appreciate it when people like Lisa actually agree to come on the show and actually show up. It's not been our universal experience. People are busy, and sometimes you get people who make agreements to participate, and then they can't honor those agreements. In any event, I hope you found the show as interesting as I did, and I hope you'll be back and join us again next week. Same time, same station.